Hey everyone, it's Glenn from home, DepecheDashMode.com, and welcome to Breathing in Fumes. On this episode of the podcast, I have very special guests Kevin May and David McElroy. They are the authors of the forthcoming Halo book, which is a book dedicated to the story of the classic album Violator. On this episode, we talk all things Violator, the record, the era, just get way into it and have a lot of fun. So hope you enjoyed this episode, and let's jump right in.
We were searching for someone else to work with us on the album, Flood, who we worked with on this album. We wanted someone basically who could give us a kick now and again and be able to pull us together and make the best of the songs without necessarily just our perspective on it. I think that was really important to this album, you know, and definitely at the end as well, someone like Francois Kevorkian coming in and mixing the album, you know. I mean, it wasn't an easy album to make, but it was enjoyable, I think, personally, you know.
Welcome to Breathing in Fumes. I'm excited to have the authors of Halo, the book about Violator. How's it going?
Hi, Glenn. Thanks for having us on.
Good evening, thanks, Glenn, from the UK. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for pretending we weren't talking before this to make it sound natural.
How have you been?
It's been forever. No, they were just arguing about soccer, football, whichever term applies. But thank you for so much for coming on the podcast. I'm really looking forward to getting your insights because Violator for me is a special time of my youth, but just such a special time in general for the record and Depeche Mode. But I think, you know, best way to start is probably noting the passing of Andy Fletcher. How did you guys hear the news?
I actually heard it from one of you and my fellow administrators in the home, Daniel. He sent a message to our WhatsApp group and it just popped up.
Oh.
And so I went to Twitter to check it and then saw the news and really from there got straight in touch with Kevin. Because the week that Fletch passed away was the week that we handed over our text to our editor, Matt, to have a look at. Was it the day before, Kevin, I think?
Yeah, I think it was the Tuesday night, our time, that we sent our manuscript to Matt. And it was Thursday evening, our time, that they announced that Andy had passed away. So it was a very strange 48 hours, the high of finishing something like a manuscript to a very sad low of hearing that news.
Yeah, similar. I was working, and Sean Sallow, another home administrator, he texted me the Instagram post, and when I read it, it didn't even register. I was just like, wait, what? And it's just, you know, I haven't done an episode since his passing, so I just wanted to make sure to note it. And I thought it was really cool that you guys dedicated the book to Andy's memory. Now, I'm assuming the timeline for the book's promotion was kind of planned and finished around the same time as that or similar? Was Andy's passing kind of something you had to kind of really reevaluate how you were going to roll the book out? Or did you just kind of go ahead with the plans you had?
We slowed down a bit. The original publication date that, to be fair, without Andy passing, I don't think we would have hit anyway, but the original date was the 5th of August. But I think Kevin and I had, before Andy passed away, realised we needed a bit more time. But what we thought was, once we got that news and like all Depeche Mode fans took it in ourselves to just process it more than anything else, we felt that the right thing to do and really the only thing we could do was push the book back because Andy passing away and that being dealt with by Depeche fans and thought about and talked about was much more important than our book coming out.
I couldn't see Depeche Mode fans looking at this as something to capitalize on, but there's perceptions out there. So I was just curious if there was much to change in the timeline.
I suppose the only thing to mention on that, Glenn, is that I think the funeral took place what would have been just 2 or 3 weeks before the original publication date as well. So I think we've certainly felt comfortable pushing it back. I think it was seven weeks in the end. And I don't think we're betraying any trade secrets here, but actually book distribution. The writing stuff has been done since, you know, the middle of May, as we said when we handed it to our editor. But the mechanics of book distribution are quite something that we've been learning. Well, we've been learning a lot about over the last 7 or 8 weeks. So that was another reason why we had to delay a little bit until the end of September, the 29th of September. Mm-hmm. So,
any pressures from the publishers? Like, was that a concern, or were they like, "Hey, we're just going forward"?
None at all. They've been they've been wonderful with us pretty much since I spoke to them originally a couple of years ago, and when we started throwing our kind of go live date. When we would be able to send stuff to them, they've been very accommodating. We've got a wonderful woman there that we work with. A shout out to Becky, if we can, who's been our kind of handler for the last 5 or 6 weeks.
Poor Becky.
So there's no pressure from them at all. So,
oh god,
yeah, Becky's had a tough time dealing with us. Yeah.
Poor Becky. I'm glad there was no pressure there, and like I said, I don't think any Depeche Mode see this as capitalizing on Andy's passing or anything. And yeah, I'm really excited to get the book out, you know, as I'm sure you are. But I'm here with Kevin and David, the authors of the forthcoming Halo book. And I know you've already kind of answered this a few times, but quick and easy, how did the project come together?
I guess we could put it into two stages. There's the bit that I kind of started, and then there's the really interesting bit when David joined. So my bit was that quite a few years ago, I just happened to be traveling home from a work event in London on the train, and the train takes about 50 minutes. And it was probably, I think I've become less of an album listener in their entirety as the years have gone by. I guess we can blame
most people have.
And it
streaming
was just
and playlists.
Exactly. And it was just by chance that I was sat on a train and I listened to the album in its entirety, and I was slightly daydreaming as well. And I got to the end of it and thought, "Oh wow, it's so good." And I think I watched or rewatched for gazillion the time the DVD documentary that came out in the mid-2000s, and I've always thought that's been pretty good. Yeah, I've always thought that's pretty good, but there's so many other questions around not just the making of the album, just the era in general. And that was kind of when I had, for better or worse, the aha moment to at least discover how easy such a project would be. I think I haven't mentioned this in other interviews yet, but I think one of the initial thoughts maybe to do is as a series of blog posts, which David has since done for the 30th anniversary, infinitely better than I could have ever done it. So, but
David has a blog?
Yeah, well, just some, or maybe some kind of newsletter or something. And I wasn't quite sure.
I don't like to talk about it, don't I?
But I had an
excellent blog.
I had a good friend of mine who'd published a book, a travel book. That's the industry I used to write about as a journalist. And he just said, "Well, let me introduce you to my publisher. Why don't you consider writing it as a book?" Which then obviously changed the entire scope of the project from in every possible angle that you could look at it from whether it was resource, time to length. You know, you can't release a book of 10,000 words, for example. You've got to make it worthwhile people's money to buy and all those kind of things. So, and then I then spent some time doing the first kind of run of interviews, which was a terrific period, actually, just doing that and meeting lots of interesting people and stuff like that. And then let me introduce you to my glamorous assistant David McElroy to take over the story.
Yeah, that's me. As you have both mentioned and I have not yet mentioned, I run a blog called Almost Predictable Almost, which is a fairly flippant look at Depeche Mode and their history, and tends to go a bit over the top with certain projects.
It's good.
Basically Kevin and I first got to know each other during the Global Spirit tour. When he and I met at the BBC Six Music warm-up show at Glasgow Barrowlands.
Oh,
which was I may have said I've been there before, Glenn, I can't remember. I told you I keep this one quite quiet, but the Barrowlands is normally a venue that holds about 1,900 people, and on that night it held about 1,700, I think, because of all the BBC equipment. And Depeche played a kind of hour long warm up show there. Kevin and I met afterwards, and then I had the idea of doing the Global Spirit Tour project, which saw my blog review all 130 gigs on the tour, and featured some very important guest reviewers such as the pair of you. And again, through that, Kevin and I got in touch. And at the end of the tour, he asked if I'd like to help out with Halo. And
very cool.
I basically jumped in straight away and said yes without any hesitation. Mainly because Violator's my favourite Depeche Mode album. It's the album that got me into the band, and it's one that I've...
You have a copy or two, right?
I think I've got a cassette version or something. I can't remember. I'm sure I can do it. One Russian bootleg. It's only got three songs on it, but it's good though. I like it. Yeah.
When David says with no hesitation, he's not exaggerating. It was literally yes. Fine. What do we do next? Kind of thing.
Very pressing.
Yeah, and I think one thing that Kevin and I had a chat, and he explained to me what he'd done with the book so far, and I think because of the sheer volume of work Kevin had done, he'd reached a point where he couldn't quite work out where to take the book next. I hope that's fair, Kevin. And
that's very fair.
So he asked me for some input and how I would approach it. And I basically immediately swallowed the idea of doing any kind of collector-based stuff, because that's more for my blog and for the kind of technical aspects my blog delves into. And instead tried to think of, well, how would I help out telling the story of the Violator era, basically. So we had a good chat, right, came up with some ideas, and took it from there.
Now, I don't know if the band have a blanket "we don't work with biographers" type policy, but they don't seem to when you read like the different books. Did you guys have any issues with that as you were approaching it? Because it's not really about, I mean, it is about the band, but it's about an album and an era.
Yes.
Did you run into any walls with kind of I don't know, statement like, we know you don't participate in those things, anything like that?
The short answer is we did run into a very big wall, and the wall is that they, we were told that they don't want to help because they don't work with biographers. They never have done. Mm. There's never been an official, body of printed work that's had any input officially from the band. And I kind of knew that when I started on the project, all those years ago. But, I did make the official approach through a couple of avenues through the UK, the publicist here, Barbara Chiron, the infamous publicist here. And then I just approached the band's management in the US and had a very kind note back to say, sorry.
Yeah, no, we passed.
Yeah, basically. So yeah. best of luck or something like that. And I was very disappointed for about 30 seconds. And then I realized that was the answer I was expecting anyway. So, don't worry about it. But then as you kind of digest what you need to do next, given that there is not going to be any official contribution from the band, then it opens up a whole range of opportunities for other people to talk to. And this isn't an excuse. It's really going to sound like one. But, I would imagine some people would be quite satisfied with a book about Violator that only spoke to the band and got their input. And I think this kind of forced me into that first phase. And then when David came along, to just think of as many people as we could that would be interesting to give their perspective. And that's what we've ended up getting. I think there's 21 or 22 interviews that we've done between us. I had about 30 hours of interviews to transcribe from the stuff just that I did. There's a lot of content. So yes, disappointed that they weren't going to be involved. Two, not surprised, got over it very quickly. And three, I think it actually ended up being a really solid kind of backgrounder and an analysis on this pivotal era.
Well, one of the things that I think is really interesting about what you guys have created here with this book is how you've made maybe things that people would consider nuts and bolts, or just, you know, they kind of skip over in a liner note, like they read the lyrics and then they don't go much past, is you made that part very interesting. And with, you know, when you interview engineers and sleeve layout people behind all these different aspects of the record, it tells a bigger picture than, you know, the 45 plus minutes that are just seared into our mind. You know, you start peeling away at it. And I think the book really paints that picture. And I think it'll be very interesting for fans. Like, who were some of the people, Quick and Easy, that kind of were able to give you some insights that people might not expect? Obviously, you interview Francois Kevorkian. His work is on that record is legendary. It's considered one of the best mixed records ever. But what were some names of people that might not be as familiar that really kind of helped paint the picture of what you guys are doing here?
Well, Kevin, really, I'm probably answering this for you, Kevin, apologies, feel free to jump in, but the book can almost be split into two halves, I think, really, for the work Kevin did initially and then the bits that kind of came together when I joined. So Kevin had spoken to Francois, he spoke to Richard Bell, he spoke to Gareth Jones to get some kind of Depeche-related background, if I can put it that way.
Didn't Gareth say, like, it's his favorite album because he didn't work on it?
Yeah, he did.
I love that quote. Oh, God.
It was a very honest answer. Kevin also spoke to Pino Piscatolla, who was one of the engineers in Milan, and Roberto Baldi, who worked there as well. Phil Legg was somebody we spoke to, and also Paul Kendall as well, who's perhaps better known for his work with Recoil. Yeah, our editor Matt put us in touch with Paul, and he gave us some really interesting stuff. So we also, Neil Ferris is involved in the book, Bruce Kirkland, Andy Franks as well. So there's plenty of, you know, people who Depeche Mode fans will know as being part of Depeche Mode history, if you see what I mean.
For nerds like us, you know, a lot of those names are names that we've kind of looked up and looked at their other works. Yeah. But you present it in a way that is very accessible to people who might not normally look those things up. So I love how you guys are rolling those quotes out from the various people through Instagram, kind of the way you're starting to market the book. Where'd that idea come from? Love that.
That was Kevin's, I think, that one.
Yeah, for fear of taking the credit on that one. That was...
Well, if you're not following on, be sure to follow them on...
Seen it done on other kind of
social media.
Yeah, well, so that was just, you know, it's a way of teasing. It's a way of teasing not the best quotes, but some of the quotes, and a good illustration to potential readers as to the broad depth of people that we've spoken to, as David said, from engineers in Milan and in London, that was David Brown and Phil Legg in London, and to one of the dancers in the Halo video, the lucky recipient of Martin Gore's attention in the Clean video. And one of the ones that I was particularly pleased with tracking down, because he'd never been interviewed about it before, was Richard Smith. Not Richard Bell. Richard Smith worked at Area.
Oh, yes.
Which is the design agency that worked alongside Anton. And it turns out, and I'm not giving away too much out of the book here, but, you know, he deserves an awful lot more credit than he gets. And I think it was interesting. We wrote something on Twitter when we put his quote, his soundbite up last week. And I said, you know, he's one of the unsung heroes of the Violator and certainly Songs of Faith and Devotion era, because he designed all the sleeves and the covers and things like that. And someone from Mute chimed in and said, oh, he wasn't an unsung hero at Mute Towers. They certainly realized and recognized what he gave to that kind of creation of the work. And it's interesting because Anton is credited quite rightly as part of that narrative of the kind of the visual image of Depeche from, you know, 86 onwards, but more specifically from Violator onwards. And it's always Anton and Depeche, but there is certainly one very important figure behind the scenes, and that's Richard Smith. And he was a delight to talk to. He gave us lots of things about, you know, initially, Anton, for example, did a lot of the work on the first single, Personal Jesus, but by the end, it was a lot of it was being done by Richard. He was just kind of feeding off Anton's kind of stream of consciousness. As you know, I think Anton has said many times before, and as Richard Bell says in the book, you know, Anton doesn't really write much stuff down. He doesn't write scripts for his videos. He doesn't
artists.
Creatives, you know. So it's interesting that he was that Richard Smith was certainly feeding off Anton and helping him frame the very much the look and feel of the visual work to do with the sleeves.
I think one thing we wanted to do as well, well, we more discovered this as the project kind of ran on, that we wanted to make sure that we told as best we could the story of the album really from start to finish. Starting at the end of the Rose Bowl gig and going all the way through to the end of the World Violation Tour. And to do that, we wanted to, you know, in the absence of any contribution from the band, we wanted to look at really every aspect of it and try and find some new stories to tell about an album that's obviously now 32 years old and has had a lot of its stories told already. But we think we've pulled together an awful lot of interesting content, which I think, and don't take this the wrong way, Glenn, because I am the same as you, but people like you and I will not have heard before, you know.
Awesome.
And there's a few gems in there which when I was reading the interviews Kevin had carried out before I became involved, I was really reading them technically as an author, but I ended up reading them as a fan because there was a lot in there to get excited about. So we've delved deep into it to the extent that, for example, we tracked down a Danish gentleman called Niels Tuxen, who
this
is named
in
the Violator sleeve notes. I thought, well, who's he? And so I looked into him, and he was the first, at least credited outside musician to appear on a Depeche Mode album. So I tracked him down through his Dutch fan club and got in touch with him. And then his daughter got in touch with me, and through her, I interviewed him briefly just to find out what he did on the album. So we've got that story there as well. So we've tried to come at it from every conceivable angle that we could think of.
Yeah.
And we think we've told as complete a story as anybody can when you don't have Depeche Mode in the room talking to you about it as well.
Right. Well, when I think about the record, sometimes my nerd brain goes to the setup for it. And I think back to the successes of Music for the Masses. And I don't think they had the pressure to follow up on a, because they had 101 in the Rose Bowl and it was a building. You know, it's not often that a band gets better as they go. Usually the first couple records are then they drift off. And so Music for the Masses, I think, in some ways set up the working environment for Violator, because it was the first time they worked with a different producer. They weren't with, you know, Daniel and Gareth, and that, you know, they were trying something different. That went well. They saw success. And I think they were eager to kind of move on in that direction. And I think, you know, then they start working with Flood, and, you know, from all accounts, apparently it seems the recording of Violator was there was a great atmosphere and mood in the band. They all comment, you know, how much they enjoyed making the record. In your discussions, did you get any little bits of, you know, kind of the new way they were approaching things, or comments on the mood of recording the record?
That's one for you, perhaps, Kevin. Again, with your interview.
Yeah, and yeah, I think
without giving too much away.
Dave is quoted as saying in an interview many years after that, when the four of them were together, recording Violator was the most fun they ever had.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of reflected mostly in all the interviews that I did. So, for example, the Milan guys, Roberto Baldi and Pino Piscatola, they were very young. They were very young engineers at Logic in Milan. And kind of once they'd had their heads put back on their shoulders, because they'd been blown away when Depeche walked in the door and they suddenly realized which record they were going to be engineering for the next 6-7 weeks. They had a lot of fun. There was a lot of experimentation in the studio. There was a lot of fun in the evenings. They would hit the Milan nightclubs fairly regularly after recording. But one of the things that they both said was this really strong work ethic, that even though they were partying quite a lot in the evening, there was very much a, they would get in the next day, they would work 10 hours or whatever into the evening, have dinner, then go out. And because they knew what, you know, they're on the clock because it's studio time and it's booked, but they still knew that they had other studio time booked for a few more months down the line in the Pook studio in Denmark and then in London to finish off various bits and pieces. But those two certainly were very impressed, one by the work ethic and two by the camaraderie between the production team and the band. You know, let's not forget that this was the first time that they'd ever worked with Flood, and Flood introduced some fairly revolutionary ideas, which may not seem very revolutionary now, but they certainly were to Depeche in that May of 1989. And
well,
go ahead.
It's interesting. Now we're surrounded by dance music, electronic music, but at the time, you know, if you put yourself in 1989, 1990, you know, what they were doing, you know, with textures and soundscapes, you know, they were obviously progressing on who they were as a band. But I mean, when that record came out, I mean, you hear all these little sounds. Every time you listen, there was something new. And yeah, just the stuff they were doing was just a continuation of the idea of when they were sampling pebbles rolling down a windowsill. You know, I mean, it was just forward, constantly forward and pushing who they were and how they were using the technology of its time. They still do that now, but you know, what's interesting for me is after Music for the Masses, you know, they kind of agreed like the demos, Martin's demos would be more open. And so the, as a band, they could kind of reinterpret the songs. And I'm just trying to think, the Enjoy the Silence demo came out, and I remember for years and years, and I'm like, that's how basic all the demos must have been, you know? And then the, I remember in the late 90s, you know, trading bootlegs and stuff, I got one of the studio rough mix of Halo. Yes, obviously wasn't Dave's final vocal, and it had a beat in the beginning, you know, the intros, you know, it was a rough mix. And, you know, in my head, I was just, I fascinated with what they were changing. And it wasn't until the demos released for Sounds of the Universe, the box set, that we kind of got a little more of a snapshot with the two demos that were on there. And those were actually a little more complete than I thought they would have been.
Yeah, I think the demos for Violator have kind of grown this mystique over the years of being, you know, it gets to the point people are talking about this being so basic as just Martin singing and clapping his hands or something. But there was always a bit more to them than that.
Yeah, yeah, as we've learned.
The Enjoy the Silence story is well told, obviously, with the harmonium style demo, and that obviously the harmonium version features on the limited 12-inch, etc.
And Martin's reaction to them moving it in a different direction wasn't exactly thrilled.
No, it turns out he was slightly wrong with that one.
Yeah, but, well, they got him on board.
They got him on board, and you know, he did okay with it himself. he'll be fine with that song forever. I think one thing, I think Kevin, again, I keep passing these over to Kevin. Kevin can maybe flesh it out more. But one thing we discovered, that before Francois got involved in the mixing, Halo was a much, perhaps for want of a better phrase, rockier track. And it was Francois had sprinkled these kind of disco dust over it type idea.
He's good.
Yeah, that's right, wasn't it, Kev? It was Halo, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I think it was Steve Leon who told me that the, and I think he says he preferred it, the rockier version, or the pre-Francois version.
I wonder if that's why the remix, that Head Cleaner remix, was like, was that for Halo?
Clean, wasn't it? I think Head Cleaner.
One of them was like a rockin' remix.
Yeah, No, it wasn't Clean. Was it Nothing? I'm not gonna have to look this up. This is the sort of stuff that we should know off the top of our heads.
I know. Just too much. But Halo was Goldfrapp. Never mind. They took that in a direction. So yep. Anyway, I derailed the conversation. But so there was a
rock. No, I was just going to say it was Yeah, it was just Steve who said that the pre-Francois version of Halo was far less electronic and rockier, whether that's the percussion or whether there was, you know, just the bass was a little bit more kind of rocky bass than the kind of electronic bass that it sounds like now. So, you know, it's interesting that there are some who thought that version was better. And it makes you wonder if Halo had come along in the Songs of Faith and Devotion era, how rockier it would have been, just to kind of throw that out there. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I know in an interview around the time the record was released, Martin Gore was being interviewed and he said, you know, we had to re-record Policy of Truth because it sounded too much like Depeche Mode and they were trying to get away from that. You know, they always try to move forward, but he's like, you know, it might sound stupid, but we couldn't get the song to not sound like Depeche Mode. So knowing that there's another version of Halo besides the studio rough mix that got out, you know, there's another version of Policy of Truth sitting somewhere, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it probably doesn't exist.
Those vaults are very busy with Depeche material.
Yeah.
I should say before people write in and complain, the remix we were talking about earlier, which we all knew to be the case, was the remix of Nothing by Head Cleaner from the remixes 8104.
How do I remember that Head Cleaner did it? And I don't remember the name of the song. Right. Oh, God.
Nothing. So,
one of David's all-time favorite Depeche tracks.
I'm wrongly abused for this. What I say is that I find Nothing to perhaps not be the standard of other tracks around it on
The masses. I actually thought you were commenting on Dave Gahan because when he, I don't know if you saw it, there was a fan visit. Liz Dwyer from LA got to visit the band and watch him. Mm-hmm. And they released a video and she was having him sign a copy of Music for the Masses. And she asked him what song he liked on it. And he commented, "Oh, I really liked Nothing. That was one of my favorites." And anyway, that's what I thought you were referencing. David, you don't like Nothing?
That's why I don't like it. It's just just a bit weak. And on 101, Dave does air guitar along to it, and there's no place for air guitar. And
that I agree with.
I think we're all there on that one. Yeah.
Well, you know, apparently, I was always, when I listened to the record, and then, you know, fourth single later for World in My Eyes, they throw these amazing B-sides on it. And I was trying to think of where those songs would fit in if they were to include them on the record. And I can see why they didn't include them. But, you know, Sea of Sin and Happiest Girl didn't need to be B-sides. They were so good. And apparently they recorded a song. I don't know the details. I just know fan speculations. But for years and years, we've always talked about a track called Mother Me that apparently was recorded that they just got rid of and never... I don't know. Do you guys have any answers? We know anything about anything that one?
I think we've both heard the story of this song existing before, and unfortunately nothing came out as part of the book, so we're not going to be issuing a surprise flexi disc with the book or anything at all.
Well, I think Daryl Belmonte made a quote that it does exist, and liked it or something. But I could be remembering that wrong. But well, speaking of B-sides, you know, the introduction to the record a few months early was Personal Jesus, which the band had mixed reactions to, you know, like they wanted a change in a first single, similar to the comments they made about Barrel of a Gun. And they released something so different. But the B-side, Dangerous, which is obviously a fan favorite, I've always considered kind of like, hey, we're still Depeche Mode, but check this out in Personal Jesus. Do you remember when that came out, how different and shocking it was?
Yes, I think the thing with Dangerous is, first of all, it provides it's basically a kind of neat bridge from Music for the Masses era, or that kind of initial era of Depeche Mode, if you want to call it the 80s era, although I hate using the phrase the 80s, but anyway, the 80s era. And that then, you know, as you say, it was still electronic. It's a very Depeche Mode song, and Personal Jesus certainly wasn't a Depeche Mode song. So having that as part of it, as part of that package, kind of made sense to link the old to the new. it's still, you know, the thing with Dangerous is it is an outstanding song. As you say, it's a fan favorite, and I think the Essential mix on the 12-inch is just one of the it's a perfect version of that song. It would have been a song, I think, that might not have fitted in Violator, just because it sounded too previous era Depeche Mode, if I can put it that way. It doesn't quite have the kind of clean electronic feel that the rest of the album does, although I'm sure Alan and Flood would have seen to that, as would Francois.
Yeah, I mean, that's, if you look at the story or the releases of singles, I mean, getting a B-side that's about as good as the A-side is rare, you know?
Yeah.
There's only a few examples that come to mind, and that's one of them. I mean, mm-hmm. you flip it over and it's just as good as the A-side. Yes. Not that anyone remembers A and B sides much anymore, but
double A sides come to that.
Those right. Yeah, exactly. No, it was just interesting because I remember being thoroughly shocked when I heard it. And then when I bought the single and I heard Dangerous, I just remembered like, oh, you know, like having, you know, like, oh, they're still Depeche Mode. And because it was shocked. I mean, and they did the same again in 93, you know, when you saw Dave with long hair, like, whoa. So they, you know, it isn't new for them. They like to come out and shake things up and change who they are and announce each record with the bang. And I think Personal Jesus was, I don't know if that started it, because, you know, Strangelove was, how many months before Music for the Masses? At least 6 months, Strangelove was
released. Yeah, Strangelove was April, wasn't it? And the album, I think, was September from,
memory
here, so.
They weren't even done with the record when they released it. Yeah. So, you know, similar thing, but this time dramatic change with Personal Jesus. But the song is very electronic. You know, you get into the after the shocking bluesy guitar riff, you're like, you hear so much Depeche Mode in it. But
yes, that's right. Yeah.
Where was it going? Oh, you know, it's funny. Speaking of the early era of the band, I in preparation for this, I was watching a lot of interviews of the band at the time. And it's interesting that in the UK interviews, they had to kind of still defend themselves because of who they were in their early days, you know, with all their pop single success and all that. And then in America, they're just exploding. It must have been a very, like, bizarre time to be in the band. Like, in one side they're like, hey, this album's really good, but you guys did this. And on the other side they're like, can you believe what's happening over in North America with this record? Any you know, as you discussed people, was there any did that come up much, just the general mood of the band during this time of getting the record out?
I think as Kevin said earlier, the mood within the band itself was fairly upbeat, because I think, you know, one thing Depeche certainly then, perhaps even now, seem very able to do is just drown out everybody else and focus on what they're doing. So, you know, they were in Milan having a wonderful time going out clubbing. They know that had a wonderful time when they got to Denmark as well.
Yeah.
But Personal Jesus was released back at home. Some of the music press liked it. Some of the music press just said, you hear a Depeche Mode again, just being fairly dull type thing, to paraphrase, I think. Then yeah. ME were particularly savage about it. And Depeche just weren't taken seriously at home, whereas, as you say, in America, they were just exploding all over the place. Europe as well, of course, absolutely loved them and had done for many years. It's just really at home they were treated fairly insultingly, really, to be honest. It was... And it took a long time for that to go away. Violator helped change that perception generally. But I think you'll agree, Kevin, it's never really changed too much at home until very recent years.
Yeah, there's an interesting perspective on this from one of the Mute people in Germany on one of those documentary DVDs when they're talking about the Exciter era. And this isn't relevant to Violator, but I think it's an interesting context. And it's, you know, by the time, and probably it started around Violator and Songs of Faith and Devotion, but there's a kind of a changing of the guard amongst music critics every kind of 10 to 15 years.
Oh, right. I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So all those music critics that would have lambasted Depeche for appearing in videos holding chickens and lots of other bizarre things in that kind of early to mid 80s.
Those kid TV shows are hard to watch.
Those kid TV shows,
they're on the telephone.
Not to answer for. You know, when you get into the 90s, there's a whole new era or generation of music critics who take that, you know, who are taking the music at face value and don't have the historical context to berate them with. So, you know, that's why I think certainly towards the end of the 90s, there was this kind of appreciation for what they were doing as artists rather than disappreciation for fear of making up a new word for what they did to get themselves in the limelight in the early 80s.
Well, I think they just proved them all wrong. They got to a point where it's like, you can't deny what they're doing anymore. And Violator was like, yeah, this is who we are, you know?
Yeah, and I think it would be fair to say that, you know, with Violator, everything that they put out was excellent.
Right.
David said that there was some criticism of Personal Jesus, but, you know, you got to be really tough going and have a heart of stone to not appreciate Enjoy the Silence for all its brilliance as a pop song, as a piece of production, everything. So I think, you know, there's this kind of era, again, to use that word, where they're just putting out really high quality creative work, for want of a better phrase, songs and the subsequent tour and stuff like that, that maybe woke up a lot of the critics. Oh, okay, well, yeah, maybe we need to kind of get over the fact that we just used to take the piss out of them, because right. Now they are serious artists. They look terrific, courtesy of Anton and Richard Smith and all those kind of things, and the quality of the songs and the production is there. We've got to take these people seriously now.
Yeah. Well, the thing I found interesting, because I rewatched the documentary on the remaster, and one thing I just kind of dawned on me that they just kind of kept going on and on and on about their success in the States, North America, and you know, the riot, in store. You know what I'm talking about, at the warehouse,
yeah.
And then Dodger Stadium. I mean, they did that in New York. But it just seems like they were really focusing on, when they look back, just their successes in America. And I was just like, you know, they proved a lot of people wrong in their home country then. I wish they would have, I guess they don't want to gloat or whatever, but do you think there's too much focus on the Violator era on their success in the States?
Perhaps. I mean, I think when you look at the warehouse incident, for example, that was covered on a British television program at the time called The Word, which was a decent enough program. But when I look back at it now as part of the research, the report was a fairly sneering report about, you know, how could Depeche Mode cause a riot type idea. And right. The coverage of the warehouse in the British music press was, again, fairly derogatory. You know, basically saying it's funny that the notion that anybody would riot for Depeche Mode was hilarious.
What's wrong with the Americans?
Stadium. I say, exactly. Why are they rioting? Don't they? Yeah, well, see, yeah. at the time in Britain, everybody else was rioting about a thing called the poll tax, or just generally at every football match every Saturday. So, you know, we knew what riots were.
Right. Yeah.
The show as well, The Words, covered the. Again, I stand to be corrected. I think it was a Giants Stadium gig rather than the two Dodgers gigs, so I may be wrong, but it was one of them anyway. And again, it was covering it, saying Depeche Mode are playing this massive baseball stadium. Can you really, you know, the angle really was, can you believe that Depeche Mode are doing this sort of thing?
They sold it out twice, Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, that's it. So there's this kind of sense, a kind of permanent sense of disbelief, and then Violator proved it wrong, and then Songs of Faith and Devotion came along. So I think it helped change perceptions in Britain, but at the time, the perceptions hadn't really shifted because it was still just Depeche Mode.
Well, and I think they were using these moments to kind of justify themselves. Like, yeah, we did that, you know, and absolutely deserved. But I remember going, man, there's really a focus on all this, you know, that especially on that documentary about everything that was happening here. And I was like, you know, the tour was sold out all over Europe, everywhere. You know, they went to Japan and Australia. Yeah. And, you know, I wish they would have kind of discussed some of those things a little more. But I get they can't do a 10-hour documentary, but it was Violator, you know.
Mm-hmm. I suppose what's quite interesting just on that kind of perspective is the what was else was going on, and we have, I'm pleased to say, covered this in the book, and that was, you know, the entire Violator era coincided with the fall of the Berlin Wall in late 1989 and the reunification of Germany throughout 1990, and that's not covered in that documentary. But because I'm glad to say that we have covered that, because that was a hugely important time in Western Europe and Eastern European history. I mean, we're recording this today, Glenn and David, the day after Mikhail Gorbachev has died, who was synonymous with that particular era, and we were discussing that last night on our chat, weren't we? So, but none of that's included in that documentary, and arguably, that's an even more important historical context to the era than a riot in LA over an install, potentially.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, it's interesting, too, and this is me projecting, but as a music fan, the idea that Depeche Mode reached out to this new project from Bernard Sumner and Johnny Marr that would become electronic, they asked them to open the show. And if I remember right, when they were performing, they weren't even done with the record, you know. But here's this moment at Dodger Stadium, Depeche firing on all cylinders, as they say. And you had Knights Reb, and then Johnny Marr, Bernard Sumner, and the Pet Shop Boys in a super group opening. And, you know, we always joke, like, if you had a time machine, what point in Depeche Mode's history would you go to first? And the easy answer would be the Rose Bowl, because that was a big thing for them. But I'm it might be that show for me, possibly the Black Celebration New Order Talk Talk final leg show. Like, that's in my top three. It's hard not to say the Rose Bowl because it's so obvious. That would have been pretty cool, but you know, just musically, you know, electronic support.
Yeah, no, I agree with you.
I mean, just that moment in time. And then that record comes out, and just crazy to think that they played with them.
Yeah, it was funny. If you see, and there's places online that you can find it, but the set list for electronics, set that night, I mean, half the songs don't have the names that you would recognize, because as you say, the album was finished.
The one that I like. Just...
yeah, that's a brilliant name. Yeah. So it's just
Orange Juice or whatever they were calling them. Yeah.
So it's just so funny that they were clearly not yet ready, but because obviously they know Depeche, and it's not bad promo saying we've got a new group here to 50,000 people in a stadium.
And that that may have helped sell out the second date. I don't know. I think Depeche could do that on their own there, but
those new Order and the Smiths were part of that wave of British bands, along with Depeche and The Cure, that stormed America in the late 80s. So you're having Marr and Sumner there is no bad thing. And the Pet Shop Boys as well, as you say.
Yeah. Have you heard the bootleg?
Not a bad lineup. I haven't, no. Is there one around?
I have it. Ooh. I'll have to send it to you, but it's interesting. Before Patience of a Saint, Bernard Sumner, who apparently was just out of his mind drunk, because they were so nervous, but he introduces, he goes, you know, ladies and gentlemen, the Pet Shop Boys, not Neil Tennant, Chris Lowe or whatever. He just said the Pet Shop Boys. So I believe it was Patience of a Saint. They were, those four people were on stage opening for Depeche Mode on the Violator tour. and it's not documented. There's a couple photos here and there.
On that, Glenn, I've said for a long time, there are lots of images. There's that kind of fairly rough and ready video content from the from that particular gig of Depeche.
Right.
But there's a couple of pictures that were taken by an excellent British photographer called Kevin Cummins.
Oh yes.
Who was working for the music press, and he was there to take pictures of electronic. And there's a couple of photos of them on stage, which Kevin took from stage left or something like that.
Oh, that.
And there's just Johnny Marr standing at a keyboard with his guitar over his back. And he just looks so cool. And those are the best pictures.
Yeah, those are the ones I was going to comment. There was
exactly.
There's an electronic article.
That has better... much better than any of the Depeche pictures, just because Johnny Marr just doesn't even need to try to look cool.
And Andy covered "I Feel You." I thought that was kind of cool. There's always been a little bit of a friendship there. Well, going back to Violator, you know, when we were talking about demos and rough versions and the very overly discussed stories of Alan and Flood, you know, changing "Enjoy the Silence" or whatever. But the more I hear about that record, it seems like it's, you know, I don't want to say it's Alan and Flood's record, because obviously they're building Martin's songs. But it's really interesting to me, because I think Alan was so... he should almost get writing credits for the way... I know it's a group effort and all that, but I mean, he just... seems like he and Flood were just magic with Martin's songs, and they just... completely, I mean, when you listen back to that record, I mean, even with all these years and years and years of over familiarity, like, you know, every turn, you just still like kind of blown away at what they created. And do you think Alan Wilder, I've often said,
will rejoin Depeche Mode?
No, God, no. But let Alan do, yeah.
No.
But no, I've often thought that Alan, his contributions, I've kind of lost, you threw me off, David, how dare you?
Sorry.
No, I'm just, and I'm going on about this way too long, but I don't know if he is, was this the beginning of the end? The work he and Flood did in the studio happily, and then the success of the record, and he possibly not being, you know, Martin gets all the praise for the songwriting, but... you know, was, do you think this, that was a setup for, you know, what was coming a few years later? This record in particular?
Quite possibly, because, you know, I think the thing with Violator was, it was, as Kevin mentioned earlier, that the band generally had fun doing it, but Alan really put in the hours in the studio with Flood.
Yeah,
and then obviously Alan is involved. I can't recall if Steve Leon, I think he was involved in the preparation of the live tracks there, or if he wasn't then, he certainly was in 93, 94.
Yeah.
So Alan became much more, well, he became the one member of the band who focused on the studio work.
Yeah, he was always the musician, but now he's the master craftsman.
Yeah, I think that's it. And then you move on to recording A Song's Faith and Devotion, which, well, it took a year out. I mean, World Violation ended in December 1990. And then they have this year off, but by 1992, they're all then sharing a house in Madrid, or a villa, probably, rather than a house.
And that was like a nightmare. They said, they there? How many months? And they didn't really get anything done? And they weren't talking.
Because they were all having fun in different ways. And I think Alan, he stuck then doing this in Madrid and trying to get things moving. So I imagine if he felt any grievance post-Violator, the Songs of Faith and Devotion sessions did nothing to cure that. In fact,
that's what,
now we know they exacerbated it, really. So again, it's speculation, because sadly we've not spoken to Alan or to Flood as part of the book process, but I think it's probably fairly safe to draw those conclusions. Kevin, would you agree?
Yeah, I would. I think that the way I would define it is that the seeds were sown for what was going to happen further down the line.
Right.
So, you know, it's written about and said very often that team of Alan Wilder and Flood was the dream production team for that particular time, because one, they got on very well. They bounced off each other's talents as producers and as musicians. And I think they realized what opportunity that they had, those two, to work on Martin. You know, let's not forget that Martin was having a phrase that we use here, you know, a bit of a purple patch in his songwriting. So, you know, everything that he was churning out was terrific, were brilliant songs. There isn't a dud on the album, you know, bare songwriting wise. So, you know,
if there were any frustrations, as David said, that came out of the back of Violator, perhaps they were slightly masked by just the extraordinary success of the tour and the album and everything that particular period. But once you get into Songs of Faith and Devotion, and it's here we go again at the production end, and things aren't aligning with the kind of the alchemy within the band. Now, I've got a question for both of you two, which I've in all the discussions that David and I have had over the last couple of years as we've been pulling this thing together, and we've sliced and diced the whole career of Depeche. But I'm curious about one thing. It's been documented before that after Alan left, and I think it's Daniel that said this, at least Daniel has said this, that even though they never really worked out what it was, Alan wanted to record the next album in a different way. And he just knew that wasn't going to happen. And I don't know, or would like to gauge you two experts to kind of, it's kind of related to what we're talking about with production. What do you think that way was that he perhaps would have been proposing if he had stayed?
That's a good question. I mean, you think back to some of the stuff Alan said around the time of Songs of Faith and Devotion, when either, well, probably was more likely Dave, I think, from memory, said, we need some real drums in this. And Alan's view was, oh, for God's sake, right, I'll play the drums then. You know, so I don't think that Songs of Faith and Devotion would necessarily have been the way he might have taken it, at least at his rawest element.
Whereas yeah, Dave commented he wanted to bring a rock element to the
Yeah, and Alan is obviously the only drummer in the band, so he took that on. I think perhaps Alan might have taken the album more along the lines of his sort of the Recoil albums released after he left, so more along the kind of feel of In Your Room or Higher Love, that type of kind of smoky, Recoil-like, wilder, special atmosphere type thing that he creates. I think he might have stayed more electronic. If you look at his subsequent work anyway, then that might have been the path he would have taken.
Well, I think a 1992 Alan Wilder would love today, where they could be in different parts of the world and send each other. They don't have to be in the studio anymore. I don't know enough about studio work, and I don't know if that comment was regarding to actual recording or possible, you know, credit. You know, like I said, I would think that he would, he said that there was a dissatisfaction within the band and all these different things, and maybe he wanted more people to be involved, and rather than just leaving he and Flood on an island. I really don't know. The only thing I could think of is in comments through the years, they've just kind of said Martin will be in, be out, comment, change this, leave. And, you know, maybe he would want Martin to be there in the same amount of time he was. It's interesting. I wasn't familiar with that comment, but
yeah.
What would you think, Kevin?
I don't know. That's why I was asking you two subject matter experts. We referenced Andy Wright at the beginning. I mean, and Andy said in one of those documentary DVD extra things that he didn't want to work with Alan again on another album. So, you know,
didn't they get in a fist fight on like backstage or during a show or something or after? I think they had a pretty up and down relationship, but yeah, I think they got in a fight once, like at a show, like
yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's interesting, and we can always speculate as to how things might have evolved on the next album if he had stuck around for another one. But, you know, it's now 27 years ago. I mean, it's
right.
Which is why, you know, David and our eyes roll into the back of our heads whenever anybody kind of mentions Alan rejoining and all this kind of thing, because it's a ridiculous conversation because it comes up so often. But it's, you know, to bring this back to Violator again, I just don't think, you just can't underestimate what that Alan and Flood in tandem did. And, you know, and as we've dived into in the book, when you've got those two as producers, essentially together, creating the atmospheres, building the rhythms, doing everything, making fundamental changes to a song like Enjoy the Silence. And then old Francois Kevorkian walks in the door and adds his level of creativity.
Right.
You know, you've apparently. That's the dream team, really, is once you add Francois in on top because of what he did to the record.
It was interesting, and I think the band didn't intend for this to slip, but they let it stay in the interview. In an interview during the press for Ultra, Andy said how much he hated Francois Kevorkian. I don't know if he meant him personally or his work ethic, but they made the comment like the guy would spend 3 days on a hi-hat, I don't want to give away too much about, your discussions with Francois, but anyone else in the orbit of talking about the record have any thoughts on, working with, you think about the stuff Francois Kevorkian did outside of, DJing and disco, he was working with Kraftwerk, obviously, which is apparently what interested Alan Wilder. But, he was doing remixes for, you name it. Name an alternative, in the world of alternative, quote-unquote, music of the time. The Smiths, just everybody. And in fact, Depeche reached out to him. I learned this in my little interview. Or I could be remembering wrong. He may have commented it before. But they'd reached out to him in the 80s to remix Behind the Wheel. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't do it, and so Shep Pettibone did the remix, and so he that name had been on their radar for a while. Mm-hmm. Any insights from other people about Francois's work, or did it not come up?
Kevin, I'm going to pass that one to you again, I'm afraid, because you were doing...
Yeah, that's kind of more directed towards Kevin.
Yeah, he first got the call in the summer of 1988, which is a full 10 months before he started his work on Personal Jesus.
Mm.
So he was well within the orbit, as we say, of what they wanted to do. They were already planning 10 months before they even walked into a studio. But I think just generally, certainly the guys in Milan had some very fond memories of working with Francois. They just couldn't believe how meticulous he was, which I think speaks to other people's interpretation of how he works, positive or negative. I think it's fascinating that somebody can be that dedicated to, as you said, Glenn, fine tuning the sound of a hi-hat for 3 days on end, or whatever the quote is, I think Francois, and I'm paraphrasing massively here, but Francois's response is, he accepts what people say, but wants to get it right. He thinks he knows how something will sound better if he does his intricate fine tuning on either a sound or a melody or something like that. And he's right. He's absolutely right. So frustrating as it may be to some about his methods, but the result is there on the final record, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's there for everybody to hear. We've said this a couple of times. The magic dust that he kind of sprinkled over each of the tracks to turn them into the gems that they are, that we hear on the final record.
No, I just thought it was funny because, for whatever reason, Andy Fletcher just did not seem to.
Yeah,
he didn't have a nice.
There was a particular story that Francois told us, which was about how they got hold of the. I won't give the full details away, but there's an interesting kind of recollection of how they got the sample for the Lord Jesus Christ Himself, which is the sample used on Personal Jesus. And he was very fond of telling that story. He thought that was very funny the way that had come together. And he kind of recounts that in the interview that I did with him.
Well, they'll have to buy the book to get the story.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Now, we've gone over an hour here, so we should start wrapping it up. But, okay, tough question time. Why do you hate Violator? No, I'm just kidding. No, does this...
Oh, it's awful. It's terrible.
It's terrible. This whole thing's a joke. No. Does this experience... You're going to need a break. But is any juices flowing for ideas for a possible... book about another album or another moment in the band's time, or are you guys done? This is it. Back to
I'll let David answer first. David,
yeah,
go on.
Well, I've next March, and now that I'm saying this out loud on a podcast, I can't go back to this. I'm going to be doing another month-long special for an anniversary. So there's going to be a 30th anniversary Songs of Faith and Devotion special next March on the blog, which, Kevin, whether you like it or not, you'll be writing something, and Glenn, you're going to be involved as well.
Well, happy to.
Thank you, because nobody wants to hear from me for 31 days. But, we'll do that. I really enjoy the blog style of writing because I can say what I want and take the piss a little bit without annoying too many Depeche Mode fans.
Right.
Whereas writing the book has been a different approach because you've got to write the book as an adult rather than a man-child who collects records. So doing another book... Yeah, I've really enjoyed this experience, and we have to see how this goes. I mean, if it's a success, then I guess we can say, who knows? There is, I think, you know, that we could do a very long book, for example, about classics such as Sounds of the Universe, which I'm sure people would be fascinated in.
Well, actually, you know what's funny? It is a fascinating story because, you know, the record's an interesting record, you know, highs and lows for whatever your music taste is, but just... the struggles of that tour. I did a podcast episode on it years ago about, you know, all the things, you know, with Dave, and just the universe was kind of telling him, hey, maybe you need to, you know, right, I think Dave Gahan said, hey, maybe this isn't the right thing to be doing right now, kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I think that would be a very interesting book. You know, you could talk to all the fans in Greek, the Greek fans, where they just, they couldn't perform, and the opening act had already finished. There's so many stories from that tour. More canceled shows, and oh, that would be an interesting...
Let's not forget the Royal Albert Hall was on that tour as well.
Right, and Alan.
I mean, to answer your question, though, the way we've looked at Violator is not as an album, but as an era. Because... Right.
Yeah, you didn't even get into specific songs.
We don't review the album as such, just because there's so many other interesting things to say about it. So if you look at it, if you look at their kind of history as eras and other stories to feed into the focus on a particular album, there is obviously the Songs of Faith and Devotion era, because that was a tumultuous time for the band, for Dave in particular, and, you know, Andy, may he rest in peace, had a very difficult time towards the latter end of, you know, 1994, and you know, Martin was having difficulties, and it was just a chaotic time, and that's been pretty well documented. You just need to collect loads of clippings and publish that, and that would be enough.
If you think
of other eras, finish the point, I think not Songs of the Sounds of the Universe, but I don't know. I just like the idea of that kind of Exciter era, I think is interesting, because they had survived the 90s.
Right.
Dave was kind of this burgeoning songwriter, but didn't feel it was quite the right time to say, hey, I've got some songs too. I've taken a quote that he said in a previous interview. You know, there was a brand new producer that they worked with. You know, Flood kind of came back and mixed a single for them, you know, and there's just lots of other things on. But then I think most importantly, that particular era was signed off with a really, I thoroughly enjoyed the Exciter tour.
Me too.
And I think part of it was the fact that they were back, and we knew that they could still do those, in inverted commas, events, which I don't think I'm kind of exaggerating, where I think a lot of Depeche fans consider the gigs to be events now, not just going along and listening to a band. Does that make sense, guys? Do you know what I mean?
And
I think the Exciter era was a really good demonstration that Depeche were back. Yes, we'd got the singles tour and stuff like that, but that was kind of dipping their toe back in the touring water. Exciter was really important for those reasons, I think.
Not to steer it too far away, but I think what was really interesting about Exciter, it was a return to what they were doing in the 80s when they were exploring sampling, and they were exploring the industrial sounds of, you know, Neubauten and all those things. But this time it was with all this new electronic underground music. And I remember specifically talking to a manager of the electronic department at a dance music store. And we were kind of talking about it. And he was just like, you know, I knew Depeche Mode, but man, that Exciter record got me on board. And, you know, and he was listening to all the latest electronic music, this really obscure stuff. And I think that's what they took influence from, and they put it into the Depeche world. Because you look at who remixed, very similar to Violator, where they were grabbing people really on the beginning, you know, the Orb. Bands like that, they, you know, they've always done that. So I'm just kind of pointing out the obvious. But Exciter felt, and I was going to ask you guys, what album after Exciter would you say is related to Exciter? And just to kind of jump the gun, and people, I have to defend being a huge Exciter fan all the time, but Exciter, I think, is more of a follow-up record to Violator than anything else.
I would agree.
Yeah. I think Ultra has moments, and they have stronger singles. And I think that was a statement that we're still alive, but I think Exciter is just was a perfect follow-up record in the sense that it was them returning to doing what they do, taking from the underground, experimenting, working in a different way, where they just survived Exciter or Ultra, you know, they just survived. And but we got some of the greatest singles they ever recorded in the 90s with Home and It's No Good, but some of the greatest singles. But
yeah.
What about you guys?
Yeah. I think with Exciter, I've grown to like it a lot more over the last few years, I must say, partly through having just spent much more time listening to it and writing about it. I still will never defend The Dead of Night, for example.
That's a
travesty of a song.
Yep. No, but Swedish Perfection, that album Shine, seems... I Am You, there's these brilliant songs on there.
Free Love's brilliant as well, although I think the Free Love version by Flood is preferable to the album version. I think it just gives the song a bit more zip and just it's just.
I thought it was interesting that they had Flood and Dave Bascom remix that, because prior to its release, they were kind of commenting that it has an Enjoy the Silence feel, and I think they chose those guys specifically to go, here's how these guys who produced two successful records for us would have done this song. Because, you know, I think that was very obvious, you know, like here's how Flood would do it. Here's how Dave Bascom would do it. Because they both did remixes for that record or for that single.
Yeah. I think Exciter's good. I said The Dead of Night can disappear as far as I'm concerned, but the rest of the album's decent. I think it is. It's an interesting point you make, because it certainly has more in common with Violator than Ultra does. Sonic.
Right. Not to take away from Ultra. Ultra's an amazing record.
Yeah, it's a stunning record. I still love that. I think I'm going back about 4 hours in our conversation here, but I thought I should give you a proper answer. I think that it'd be very hard to write another book about Depeche Mode, because the eras before and after Violator are so well covered.
Right.
You look at their, if you want to call it their first phase up to Music for the Masses, they were in every single magazine going. And so everyone knew everything about Depeche Mode. Songs of Faith and Devotion onwards, you don't quite have the internet yet, but there's more knowledge about what Depeche Mode are doing through that process. And given the sheer volume of interviews they carried out around that time, Depeche were revealing more about themselves in the album than they had done before. There's still an air of mystery to a degree about Violator. And that, you know, that goes as far as there being no World Violation Tour DVD, etc. That kind of old chestnut. But there's still this... Violator seems to be a Depeche Mode kind of era, as Kevin correctly calls it, that happened, but nobody's quite sure exactly what happened in it, because it arrived at this point in time where they weren't doing the pop stuff anymore. They really weren't doing that many interviews anymore, bar the odd promotional interview at the outset. And... you know, you look at the fan bootlegs of the concerts, all we have are a few shaky handheld video bootlegs of concerts, so the concerts themselves are a mystery. And it has this aura to it, the Violator era, that perhaps the other eras don't have, because there is still this air of mystery to it. That probably sounds massively pretentious.
No, not at all. You know, it's funny, I hope, in
you see what I'm trying to say about it.
in our conversation earlier, I meant to comment or ask about, well, in when they were defending, or I'm sorry, like when they were talking about the record, they were still having to defend how they made their music. And that's crazy and from today's perspective. Yeah. But in the context of 1990, you know, when they're promoting it, they were like, synthesize, electro, da, 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 you know, like they had to like, huh. You know, and they were like, okay, well, we're just a band. But they were still at that point defending the way they made their music. Mm-hmm. And now they had to do it with all of a sudden getting MTV support, top 40 radio support.
Yeah.
Where they only kind of had that in certain parts of the market, you know. Now mm-hmm. they come to here in the States, we're very rock oriented, and they're just like, so synthesizer band, huh? You know, and then they always dealt with that. But even in Violator, like Enjoy the Silence is heavy rotation on American MTV, and they're just like, so tell us about sampling, what's a keyboard, you know. I was like, oh god.
you don't have any drums, how do you make drums? Yeah,
how dare you. But
it's a funny thing. I think it's by the time Songs of Faith and Devotion came around, the world had accepted that, you know, Depeche Mode were, inverted commas, a big thing, and we'd be playing big shows around the world following a big tour. Nobody, at least of all the band themselves, I suppose, were prepared for the sheer level of success the Violator gave them globally.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not,
Dave Gongo, we didn't realize people were waiting for this, you know, like it was everything hit. Everything hit. The art, the record,
everything just kind of, it just coalesced at the one time where everything they did turned to gold around that period. And it's the fact that it took almost everybody by surprise, the band, fans, I'm sure the labels, both in the UK and America. And so because perhaps there hadn't been this relentless build-up to the album that we experience now, and indeed experienced during the times of Songs of Faith and Devotion,
right.
Then the fact that it arrived and then all of a sudden all of this stuff happened, that because nobody was prepared for it, nobody's really even kind of documenting it in a way that things are documented now. So it retains this.
And they didn't want to repeat kind of mystery. Because they just released 101 and
that's right.
You know, soundtrack. They didn't want to repeat themselves and this amazing tour is, you know. You know, there's the clips are on the internet and they were on the website. You know, the Dodger Stadium video.
Yeah, the security video, like, isn't it?
Yeah, like that was fed to the big screens.
Yes.
I was just like, why can't they just release that as the official quote unquote bootleg? And I know they can't mix the sound and I don't think anyone would care. They just want to watch it. Like it just, I appreciate their attention to detail and not wanting to milk it, even though some projects seems like they're milking the fans, but you know, I think Andy Fletcher was like, why would we release that? We can't, it's unmixed, you know, it's just a soundboard. Yeah. Who wants that? We all do.
Well, that's right. I think when you look that obviously 2020 was the 30th anniversary of Violator. There was an opportunity for the band to do something that they do not normally do and say, right, we're actually going to celebrate our past here rather than not ignore it, but just not really do much with it. Here's a big Violator box set. You know, it's a shame.
Do you think Martin has, this is so much speculation, I feel kind of guilty even asking this question. Do you think, would you guys think Martin would want some of the demos held back because of how much influence maybe Flood and Alan had on those, you know, songs?
Perhaps. I mean, I think he acknowledges himself that he changed the way he did the demos for the album anyway, but you never know. Maybe enough time has passed, however, for it to really not be a problem. Well, enough
time has passed. I've taken so much of your guys' time, we should probably end there. I could talk about this era forever. I didn't even touch about, like, you know, I was in high school when that came out, and, you know, the day after the concert, you know, cheerleaders were wearing Violation tour shirts. You know, people who weren't normally traditionally into the band were, you know, went to the shows, and it was just like this, it was incredible how much mainstream success they had here, but at the same time, keep their cool cult status, you know, mm-hmm. just that whole idea of that is an entirely different conversation. So I won't torture you guys with, you know, you've been so generous with your time here. Let's go over some, let's wrap this up. When is the book available? And are pre-orders coming?
Yes,
they are. Yes, basically, the book comes out on the 29th of September worldwide in paperback and on ebook. And as of today, pre-order links have started appearing online. So, for example, at the time we're doing this in the UK, there's a link on the Waterstones website, which is a big bookshop in the UK, and it's now appearing on Amazon. It's on Amazon in the UK. Albeit you can't quite pre-order it yet. That should be, I would imagine, complete tomorrow or Friday. And I've been told by somebody in Germany tonight that it's featuring on the German Amazon site as well. So I presume other global Amazon sites are following on. So over the next few days, more and more pre-sale links will become available, and you can be guaranteed that Kevin and I will flood social media.
Well, I was going to say, is the best place for
people... No pun intended, David.
Sorry, my puns are running wild there.
I was just wondering if Kevin was still with us. I was like, did Kevin get bored and leave?
I think if you and I started talking about records and bootlegs, I think Kevin went out for a walk and then came
Kevin's
back.
Kevin's like, oh, these two. Oh, God.
Here they go. Now,
best place for people to go to connect with you guys is the website, or does that have all the links to your Twitter and all your social media, Instagram feeds?
Yeah. all our details are on halothevioletorbook.com/contact.
So okay.
All our links to our various presences in social media are there. And if you want to get in touch with us to have a chat, give some perspective, we've also got an opportunity for actual bookstores and actual record stores and any other kind of retail establishment who wants to sell copies in their store. They can get in touch with us and we can point them in the right direction of some of the different options that they have to do that. So, you know, the main distribution and selling of the book is through online retailers. Although, hot news, my local bookstore today said that they would stock it because I'm a local author, which was
nice.
Which made me blush ever so slightly because I'd never even thought of myself as a local author in my little town here in the Shires of London, in the Shires of the UK. So you can get it in bookstores, but if you are a record or bookstore listener right now and you want to get some physical copies, just get in touch and we can give you, as I said, the options that are available to do that. So
the main way
to get it is online. Yeah,
and I'll post the links as well in the episodes.
Yes, I think if you follow us on Twitter as well, we're always there talking about it. So the main Twitter handle is at Halo Book. That's where you can find out all the stuff happening. Really, as soon as we find out, we tweet through that. And obviously, there's Kevin and my own private accounts, which you can easily find if you look at Halo Book, and you'll be able to find out as much information as you can possibly stand by following a number of those accounts.
In between soccer, football arguments.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And well, if you look as well at the, I'll obviously mention it on the home site, depeche-mode.com, and also my blog as well, Almost Predictable Almost, will contain all the information and even more of the usual nonsense.
Now, for anyone listening here, they have been so kind to talk to me during a very special game. Is the game ended?
Kevin's game has ended. Yeah, match or game, that's fine. Kevin's team have won. My team are currently drawing 1-1 with 20 minutes to go, and they've been playing like donkeys for the most of this game. So.
Well, I have to say, I have completely fallen in love with Ted Lasso, and I think that's going to be doing a lot for growing the sport in America. Not that, I mean, it's growing like crazy here. It's insane. Yeah. But Ted Lasso definitely gave me a whole new perspective on it. So I will shut up about that. So, well, thank you so much for joining me. Let's wrap this up. Like I said, you got to just pull me away because I have 50,000 other questions I could go into. But I really encourage people to go get the book, follow the guys, and thank you for your time. And
thank you.
If there's anything I can do to help promote or whatever, just let me know.
Thank you, Glenn. We will do. And thank you for your time. And thanks everyone who's listened to another hour and a half of me and Kevin talking endlessly about Violator.
Thank you very much.
No, Glenn. I hope there's more in the future. And I think people after exploring the book and reading it will be feeling the same way. So
cool. Thank you very much.
Well, that was so much fun. I could have done that for hours and hours and hours and hours. So thank you, Kevin and David, for your time and for having such a fun, in-depth conversation about one of the greatest records ever recorded. Again, the book Halo is out on September 29th. And be sure to head over to the website, halothevioletorbook.com, for all things regarding the book. You can link up with them, contact them, and get the links to their social media to follow along. And so thrilled for them. Congrats. And you're going to love the book. Be sure to check it out. To connect with me, you can follow the podcast on the usual social media sites, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, @BreatheInFumes is how you can get a hold of me. And if you like the episode, be sure to share it with your Depeche Mode friends. And I really appreciate all the support. And thanks again to Kevin and David for making this such a fantastic episode. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks, everyone.